It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, Lab Lit, making the case for more serious, realistic fiction about science. Because if you ever noticed how many of the stories we tell about scientists sound like this?
Using layman's terms, use a rotating magnetic field to focus a narrow beam of gravitons. These, in turn, fold space-time consistent with Vail tensor.
Everybody getting this so far?
And you produce a singularity. Now,
because a psychomagnetheric slime flow of immense proportions is building up beneath the city.
She's alive! Alive!
1.21 gigawatts!
What the hell is a gigawatt?
Duh.
Use the intensifier disc. Place it in position on your right.
I guess this thing where Bob goes into the what's it here.
Now turn the control 18 degrees to the left.
You have successfully accomplished your task, Dr. Meacham. You've assembled an interocitor, a feat of which few men are capable.
So, come up to the lab.
Mad scientists, evil geniuses, and unchic geeks. There are so many ways to make fun of scientists. Well, if you're ready for something different, there's a new genre in town, Lab Lit. Serious, literary fiction with characters who do real science. Jennifer Roan runs a cell biology lab in London. She's also a novelist and the founder of a website that's at the center of the new movement. Jenny, how did this all begin?
Well, I was working in a biotechnology company, and I was doing a lot of reading. And I noticed a trend that I had noticed a little bit earlier on in my life, that there were not a lot of scientists in normal fiction. So not science fiction, but sort of mainstream novels about normal people. And I had noticed this initially when I was in graduate school, when I was given a really interesting book to read, which had lots of passages highlighted with highlighter pen. And I thought, God, these must be sex scenes. But actually, it was going around the rounds in the labs, and it was a book with scenes of explicit biochemistry underlined. It was really funny. It was a book about scientists, but it wasn't science fiction. There were no aliens
or time travel.
It was called Cantor's Dilemma by Carl Tarassi, who I'd never heard of. He's a very famous scientist. And I thought, this is great. This is a book about scientists. This is my world. It'd be great to read another story like this. So I went to the library, went to the bookshops, and I couldn't find anything. There were no other novels about scientists. And eventually I did launch my website, lablit.com, on the basis of having found a mere 120 or so novels with scientists in them ever published, ever. And the number has gone up since, you know, nearly 10 years later. We've accumulated about 200 titles ever written with a scientist as a central character.
But science plays such a huge role in our society. I mean, doesn't it seem strange and curious that the actual world scientists inhabit, their labs, their culture, doesn't show up more in fiction?
It is strange, and I also thought perhaps it is that writers tend to be arts and humanities graduates, and maybe they just don't like science. You know, there's a lot of people who avoid science as much as they can in school. The minute they can stop taking any math or science, they stop. And perhaps this sort of antipathy or fear or just boredom about science. Maybe you had a really bad science teacher and you think science is boring.
Could it also be that science just doesn't lend itself to fiction?
Oh, definitely not. Science is a really human endeavor, and there's lots of passion. There's people who are very competitive. There's people who are very jealous of other people's results. There's the opportunity for skullduggery. Of course, there's the opportunity for romance. Lots of really interesting scenarios, and they haven't been covered a million times in fiction. You know, it's brand new territory. It's sort of a gold mine of potential plots.
Well, one way you set out to change that was by writing a couple of novels yourself. Give us a quick sketch.
Well, the first one is about a workaholic. This is a male workaholic, and I know a lot of people like this who just spend 24/7 in the lab. They have no life, and this is about a man who's like this. He doesn't see beyond his test tube. So that's the first story. And the second story is a little bit more close to home. At the time that I started writing, I was working in a biotech company in the Netherlands, and it was kind of funny because this company had only one idea. It was a really, really great idea. And they were working on a product, a cancer cure, based on this one idea. And when I got there, I thought, wouldn't it be funny if this whole idea was wrong?
So, a little worse than funny.
Yes. I thought, what would happen? And then I thought, what if you were a new person like me who had just come to the lab, and the first experiment you did, or maybe the first couple of experiments you did, you suddenly realize, hey, wait a minute. What they said is true about this science is not true. And the story is about what happens next.
I know that you said that one of the things you wanted to do with those novels was to get the atmosphere of the labs right. What does that mean? What is it about a laboratory atmosphere that you wanted to portray?
Well, I think laboratories themselves are very sort of scary places. There's lots of machinery and things that go ping and lights and flashing things and funny sounds and funny smells. But within the laboratory culture, there are lots of really interesting people. Labs tend to be populated by an international group of fairly young people, you know, between the ages of 20 and 40 is the average age of a researcher. So you've got all these really interesting people from around the world stuck together in this very compressed environment where everybody's striving to discover something. There's obviously a little bit of competition going on. But by and large, the feeling of being in a lab is one of camaraderie. You become really close to what you call your lab mates. You go out together, you have drinks together, you really suffer together. And it's fun, too. People are really funny and amusing. Scientists, people don't think of scientists like that, but they actually are really funny. So when you get a bunch of scientists together in this atmosphere, they say the funniest things, they do the funniest things. There's a lot of practical joking going on. It's really stimulating. So I wanted to get that idea across, that a laboratory is a living, breathing room full of really odd, quirky, smart people, and when they get together and do things, it's an interesting story.
You know, it's interesting. I'm listening to you and thinking, not only have I not read that in many novels, I haven't seen it in film either that much. It must drive scientists like you crazy to go to the movies, and over, the scientists you see fit into, I don't know, certain cliches. There's the mad scientist, but then there are others.
They used to be. I have to say, that is not longer so true. If you look at Hollywood scientists now, they tend to be really good-looking people, like Rachel Weisz, for example. Just, okay, they may have designer spectacles, but they are Hollywood stars. Like Will Smith in I Am Legend. This was a zombie movie, or a vampire movie, but he's a scientist. He's wearing a white coat. He looks great in his white coat. He looks really sexy. He's not your typical mad scientist.
Maybe we're moving into a stage where scientists are romanticized. The brave genetic engineer saves humanity, which must be fun to watch as a scientist.
It's fun, but you know, I have to say, although the physical stereotype of the mad scientist is gone, largely, I think, from fiction, what remains is the stereotype of science as something that man was not meant to meddle with. And this is an ancient meme going back to Greece, where, you know, you have people who are getting beyond themselves, they were getting too close to the gods. You know, you're not supposed to know too much. You're not supposed to meddle. And this meme is still running through most of the films. So if you look at I Am Legend with Will Smith, I Am Legend, the whole thing kicks off because the character played by Emma Thompson, a well-meaning, sort of befuddled scientist, she's designing a gene therapy cure for something and it gets let loose and turns into this zombie virus epidemic. If you look at almost any movie with this theme, you will find that that's what happened. The scientist is well-meaning, loses control, the world's about to end. And sometimes another scientist steps in and saves the day, like Will Smith. But nevertheless, the precipitating event was a scientist who was a smarty-pants and just went too far.
So it sounds like whether they're portrayed as insane or visionary, scientists still tend to be cast as troublemakers. Is that so bad? Going back to Copernicus and Galileo, science is about challenging assumptions and paradigms and pushing the envelope.
I think you have a good point there. But we do have a PR problem as scientists. They're more trusted than other professions like journalism and politicians. But when you see polls about how, would you trust a scientist, they're not right up there. And this goes back again to why I think lab lit is important. Because if you read a really great novel or see a really great film about a really well-meaning, hardworking scientist who's obviously a human being with human problems, you might think, oh, you know, this is the science business. It's a little bit more complicated than I thought. It's not black and white. But these people are not evil. They're people just like me.
Do you think publishers are discovering that there's more of a market for lab lit?
No, I don't. The recent successes in lab lit have by and large been through established writers. So people who are already famous, like Barbara Kingsolver is a great example. Mm-hmm. Allegra Goodman's written a nice one.
Anne Patchett.
Anne Patchett is another good example. These are people who already have a track record. Mm-hmm. So if you're a debut novelist and you have a lab lit novel, I really think it's difficult. I know a few people who've done it. I've done it, and a few others, but it's not easy. The editors think that people don't like science. And I think it's because they don't like science, because They're arts and humanities graduates who hate science. And we know people are interested in science. It's a great appetite for popular science, so nonfiction books. People eat them up. They like documentaries. They like science fiction. We know people like science. And I don't understand what it is about novels that keeps science out so rigorously. It's almost as if people think novels are not compatible with science, which really bugs me, because we know it is.
Well, maybe there's some agents and editors listening. Thanks so much for talking, Jennifer.
No, you're welcome.
Jennifer Roan runs a cell biology lab in London. She's the founder of LabLit.com. She's written two novels, Experimental Heart and The Honest Look, both of them set in biology labs. The music we're listening to, by the way, is an example of chiptune music from the band Starscream. It's made from the hardware and chips of old computers and gaming systems. One writer who has had enormous success writing fiction that's full of science is Andrea Barrett. Her short story collection, Ship Fever, won the National Book Award, and she's recently published another called Archangel. Many of her characters are scientists, often 19th century biologists, and Barrett herself has a degree in biology. Steve Paulson loved the new book.
Andrea, the thing that immediately jumps out about these stories in your new collection is that they're all about scientists from various different periods of history. Why do you like to write so much about science?
It's two things, I think. One is just simply I'm interested in it. I'm a crummy scientist myself. I had thought when I was young I would be one, but in fact, my brain doesn't work that way at all. But the guiding impetus for a lot of scientists I do share, which is simply wonder at the natural world, marvel at it, how did it come to be? In addition to that, which a scientist has, I have something that lies over that, which is sort of how do people get to be in this state of wondering at the natural world? What is it that drives human beings to be so interested in these processes? Why do they ask these questions? And that, as a fiction writer, really interests me.
You said that you once wanted to be a scientist, but you were, what did you say? You were a crummy scientist yourself.
I really was. And my brain so doesn't work like that.
How does your brain work differently then? Because I mean, obviously you're fascinated by the subject matter of what scientists do, but I guess the act of doing science doesn't quite work for you.
Yeah, the act of doing science day by day is actually boring to me, and meticulously doing the same experiment over and over again. I like watching the people who are doing the experiments, and I like listening to their gossip. I think the way my brain works is almost in the opposite direction. If I'm good at anything, it's at putting things together that are not usually put together rather than taking things apart.
Now, I've certainly read other literary fiction that delves into science, but almost never with the kind of scientific detail that you go into in your stories. I mean, science is not just a backdrop for you to create a little atmosphere for your characters or your plot. The science itself seems to be central to all these stories, especially moments of scientific discovery or certain moments in history when a young scientist is challenging the old scientific orthodoxy. Are those the kinds of things that especially interest you?
They are, and that's really what engenders the stories in the first place. Again, this is sort of embarrassing. The conventional wisdom for a fiction writer is that we're supposed to start with our characters and everything else is secondary to that. And by that wisdom, science should be in the background, not the foreground. But truthfully, it is my interest in certain areas of scientific history that tends to start a story. I will get very, very interested in the idea of the ether of space and trying to figure out how someone believed that at all, how they could believe it for so long, how they could believe it post-Einstein, post all the evidence. And then something in me will begin to produce characters who could be in that state of curiosity and wonder. But it is actually the science that sets me down the path.
That's fascinating. So actually to start with kind of an abstract detail, sort of this debate over, you know, was there ether in the atmosphere? And somehow you turn that into a fictional story.
I know that's a sort of inversion of what we expect. But I would also say it's not an abstract detail in that sense. It's not an idea. What is the ether of space? It's an image related to that idea. So it's an image of in this case, these gigantic whirling machines made of iron that Sir Oliver Lodge used to whirl past each other in a way that would tell him whether ether existed or not. It's a drawing of that. It's always something sensual, something I can see or feel or touch. It's jellyfish pulsing in the ocean and a line drawing of a gigantic jellyfish from the 1870s. That image leads me into the idea, and those two things together lead me to the characters and the story.
Well, I'd love to get a taste of how you write about science. And I'm wondering if you could read a passage. And I'm thinking maybe from your story called The Particles.
Sure. The Particles is a story that goes back and forth through time from 1939 when a middle-aged geneticist is involved in the sinking of a ocean liner that he's on. It was the first ship sunk by a German submarine in World War II. But in between accounts of that time, he's looking back over his life, and we're looking back at how he was trained to be a scientist. And this passage is when he's first in college. He's a 16-year-old freshman in college. So this is him listening to his teacher and processing all that. Axel was young himself, just a few years out of graduate school, energetic and delightfully informal. When he discovered Sam's age, he laughed and said genetics was a young man's game. Alfred Sturtevant had been only 19, still an undergraduate, when he'd devised the first chromosome map. Calvin Bridges had been an undergraduate, too, and a bottle washer like Sam, when he spotted the first vermilion mutant. Who knew what Sam, the perfect age at the absolutely perfect time, might do? Theirs was a new field, Axel said, a whole new world. In class, Axel brought new terms and concepts alive with his arms, slicing the air like a conductor, his thick air sticking up in spikes. They were after more than just the study of vague factors or mysterious unit characters, he said. The gene was not simply an abstract idea. Genes were material. Heredity depended on chromosomes, forever splitting and recombining. Every living individual had two parts, one patent visible to our eyes, the me you see, the tree you touch, that was the somatoplasm, and the other latent, perceptible only by its effects on subsequent generations, but continuing forever, part of an immortal stream, that was the germplasm. Phenotype, genotype, Sam loved repeating those words. So Sam couldn't swim, so he hated his history class. When he listened to Axel talk about his work, now their work, he was entirely alive.
Oh, that is such a lovely passage. I have to say, one thing that strikes me is that I'm guessing a lot of writers would sort of be scared to go into that much detail about science in a work of fiction, the fear being that you might lose your readers along the way.
You know, I do worry about that, but there doesn't seem to be anything I can do about that except to just trust that if I'm curious about those things and I'm interested in those things, then other people are too. You know, one thing is the science I write about isn't science that's done right now, which actually is too hard for me.
Well, and it's the history of science, really, that is your subject. And each of these chapters is set in a particular moment in time. In fact, you have the date at the beginning of each story. Why so interested in the history of science?
Again, it feeds into understanding what we understand now. And it's also the case that the history of science, any example that we choose, will have adhering around it all sorts of theories that were equally popular at the time but have since been proved to be wrong. And that also really interests me. It gives us a feeling for what in our own lives that is put forth as truth might also be wrong. It makes us, I think, more usefully skeptical about what we're told to believe in the world now.
Do you do a lot of research before you write these stories?
I do a lot before, and I do much more during, because I always start the stories with an idea of what they're about. I have to. You have to start someplace. But I'm always wrong, and sometimes I'm wrong, you know, by a continent and half a century, and I'm not kidding about that.
Do you read histories of these periods, or do you try to go back to primary documents?
Letters, photographs, a lot of visual material, drawings, even paintings. If I'm working with a scientist, as I was with most of these, I like to go back and read the textbooks that they would have read when they were young. All that helps me build a character.
You know, I'm guessing a lot of people would say, you don't have to do all that research. I mean, you're writing fiction. You're not writing history here.
You
could fudge the details and
I know.
People wouldn't notice. But obviously you care.
I do care, but I know that those people are right. I spend way, way too much time doing this, and so it makes me a very slow writer. Each of these five chapters or stories took better than a year to do, and you know, there's a level on which that's just silly. Why don't I just write it already? But my imagination is somehow put together such that I can't write them unless I am fully at home in that world. And that's different from knowing just a few background facts. I have to absorb enough material thoroughly enough that I can briefly experience the world and feel the world as my characters feel it.
Now, I'm curious, do you collect scientific artifacts from the past?
I do. My house is a disaster. I have a lot of old books. An anode from an old X-ray crystallography machine and a lot of fossils and bones and all objects collecting dust every day. And do I dust? I do not.
So why? Is it to, I don't know, somehow have that visceral connection to the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to hold in my hand what Henrietta was holding in her hand. I want to, you know, if she's going to feel a jellyfish, I want to feel a jellyfish. If someone else is going up in a biplane, I want to go up in a biplane. I do need to feel and touch and experience those things as my characters do.
Andrea Barrett talking with Steve Paulson. She's written 8 books, including Ship Fever, which won the National Book Award, and her most recent collection of short stories is called Archangel. And this is more music inspired by science, a track called Music is Math by the electronic duo Boards of Canada. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about fiction and art inspired by science in this hour. For years, the National Science Foundation has helped artists and writers boost their scientific literacy by spending time at the research stations in Antarctica. Novelist Lucy Jane Bledsoe went there, as did composer Paul Miller, known as DJ Spooky.
Very rarely do scientists and artists dialogue. And this program was started to make that happen so that people like me and also photographers, there, I think a choreographer went once, a couple musicians, go and spend time with scientists doing Antarctic science and then interpret it artistically. The creaking of glaciers and the drip of glaciers and the music of the wind. The wind has this beautiful, high, sailing kind of whisper that is just gorgeous.
The ice itself is a record because if you play the idea of grooves, you know, you can see layers and it, like rings of a tree, you know, it's just something where things froze and were left as a document. The ice brings all that to home.
The Air Force flies the scientists and workers in, and the artists like me, and flying in on a very clear day, I just couldn't believe how huge these expanses of ice were and how those great chunks of ice are controlling the entire planet, it was this incredible joy and almost tenderness for the continent that I discovered.
The idea was to do an acoustic portrait of the ice. So I walked around with the mini studio and went to several of the main ice fields and tried to figure out how do you get this into something that is both a natural response, you know, but also something that's highly complex. And I want to make my statement looking at this idea of polyrhythm, the wind and the ocean and even the penguins. If you ever hear sounds of penguins, they have a very cacophonous and sort of staccato style of speech. And you can do all sorts of stuff with that. If you're in Antarctica and you hear your one foot put in front of the other, you can just hear that echo around because there's no people whatsoever.
There's never been people there. So it just levels you the minute you set foot on it, in the extremity of the cold and beauty. It has this huge emotional impact. It makes the place a character. Like when you write about New York, you know, you're up against thousands of interpretations of that landscape and the millions of human voices and stories. And that's interesting, of course, in its own way, but you have to carve a story and find the city, find the landscape. Antarctica can't help but be a character in any story told there just because you're living so very, I mean, every calorie you take in, you're aware of. Every calorie you burn, you're aware of. Every piece of clothing. So it's this biological, close-to-the-bone-ness that the place gives you, and you can't ignore it.
The music I ended up coming up with was very minimalist, but also very abstract. And it was also rhythmic in a different kind of way because hip-hop, techno, drum and bass, all these styles come out of the city. And they reflect the urbanism of the reality of city blocks and repetition. But in that kind of landscape, it's a different kind of repetition.
I think I did find my voice, finally, by being somewhere so intensely beautiful. It's interesting, the long-timers who go back season after season, and most the season is usually about 5 months long, they do talk about being addicted. When you live somewhere that intense, it's hard to accept a regular mundane life.
Lucy Jane Bledsoe's novel Big Bang Symphony is about a group of scientists and a composer in Antarctica. And DJ Spooky's Terra Nova, Sinfonia Antarctica, is composed of sounds he recorded there. Writer Elizabeth Gilbert hit the big time with her best-selling memoir Eat, Pray, Love. After a roller coaster of a publicity ride and seeing herself played on screen by Julia Roberts, she went back to her first love, fiction. She wrote a big, fat, 500-page novel, which has just come out in paperback, called The Signature of All Things. Set in the 19th century, it's full of science, astronomers, sea captains, abolitionists, and a blue-stocking botanist.
Alma Whitaker is my heroine. She is a botanist, or as lady botanists were called in that day, a polite botanist. her father was a great man of botany. Her mother was an overeducated Dutch intellectual. And she comes into her own, into the world of science. And I did an enormous amount of research for this book on 19th century botanical exploration, and particularly on the women in that field, and was delighted to find that there were many of them, because botany was really the only science that women were a bit welcomed into on account of the fact that it was associated with domesticity in a way, because women have always been associated with plants and flowers. And once they snuck into it through the garden gate, they made amazing scientific contributions. And so it was a really lovely way for me to honor the lives of some of those very extraordinary early female scientists.
Were there particular early female scientists who inspired this character?
There were several. She's not based on any one person in particular, but I mean, we can sort of go through time. Her early days, I drew a great deal on the life of Beatrix Potter, who we know from Peter Rabbit fame, but who is a really avid amateur naturalist.
And home dissecting, too. Don't I remember that's something Beatrix Potter did? You think of her as this sweet woman who wrote the charming stories about little animals. Actually, she dissected a lot of those little animals, too.
Yeah, before she was Peter Rabbit's mother, she was a great taxidermist. but there were so many like her. And then, I mean, one of the ones who I really love is in my own home state of New Jersey, there was a woman named Mrs. Mary Treat who studied carnivorous swamp plants. And she was a correspondent with Charles Darwin. And that was one of the really key things for me to discover were the letters between Darwin and Mrs. Mary Treat, because they were peer-to-peer scientific letters. You know, initially I had intended to write a novel about a woman of towering intellect whose talents are not taken seriously because she's a woman. But then I discovered actually, there were quite a number of them who were taken very seriously. Darwin was writing to her for advice and questions, and she was correcting him when his science was wrong, and they seemed to regard each other as equals, and that's the tone with which I wanted to write this book.
Well, going back to the Alma's obsession with plants and eventually with mosses, I was going to ask if you would read us a little bit from the book, because who would think moss could be interesting?
So, yes, my character spends her life studying moss, and we can go more into reasons of that, but hopefully this will a bit explain her fascination. This is the part where she's discovering their wonders and marvels. In every way, mosses could seem plain, dull, modest, even primitive. The simplest weed sprouting from the humblest city sidewalk appeared infinitely more sophisticated by comparison. But here is what few people understood, and what Alma came to learn. Moss is inconceivably strong. Moss eats stone, and scarcely anything in return eats moss. Moss dines upon boulders, slowly but devastatingly, in a meal that lasts for centuries. Given enough time, a colony of moss can turn a cliff into gravel and turn that gravel into topsoil. Under shelves of exposed limestone, moss colonies create dipping, living sponges that hold on tight and drink calciferous water straight from the stone. Over time, this mix of moss and mineral will turn itself into travertine marble. Within that hard, creamy marble white surface, one will forever see veins of blue, green, and gray stained with the bodies of ancient moss colonies.
I had no idea that moss could be so beautiful, so fascinating, and so ancient. Did that surprise you?
It did, and you know, you don't get to be the oldest plant on Earth by being stupid and boring, you know? Actually, you know, what I'm seeing now is a lot of people who are realizing, oh, let's cultivate it. Let's pour some buttermilk and yogurt on it and make it grow more because it's so exquisite.
Does that work?
It does, or beer. You can just pour almost practically battery acid. I mean, anything you can do to make it as acidic as you can. They do love it. And once you begin to regard it as what it is, which is a rainforest in miniature, it's kind of hard to get rid of it once you know how glorious it is.
You grew up on a Christmas tree farm, I think. I did.
I'm an elf.
Is that where you developed a love of botany?
Well, as a child, that's where I developed a hate of botany, actually, because my mother was also a passionate farmer, and we spent a lot of our childhoods, my sister and I, out working outside, which I think very few children love, and I didn't love, but returned to it in adulthood, and now have become a passionate gardener myself, which is also what led me into wanting to write this book.
Love shows up in the person of Ambrose Pike, who is a follower of a fairly obscure, I think, 16th century writer, Jacob Bohme.
Sure. Well, Jacob Bohme is the author of this thesis called The Signature of All Things. It's also known in the scientific world as the Doctrine of Signatures. And he was a true life character and an amazing one. There is not really a type that you could call, you know, the typical 16th century cobbler, mystic, botanist, prophet, but that's who he was. And he wrote this theory surmising that God so loved humankind that the Lord had hidden in the design of every plant some sort of clue in its design as to its usage for us. So the simplest example would be to say that walnuts are very good for headaches, and if you crack open a walnut, you'll see that it looks exactly like the human brain. Mm. And that's God's clue that if you have a headache, you should eat that. And that sage leaves are very good for liver ailments, and they are shaped exactly like the human liver, as are almost every other leaf on Earth, by the way. But anyway,
you know, this could be a dangerous doctrine.
Yes, it's a dangerous doctrine, but it's a very idealistic doctrine. And it's also, I found, a very moving one because it sort of signals the beginning of an attempt at what we would now call taxonomy. You know, for all his kind of madness and dreaminess, what Jacob Bohme was really trying to do was sort of sort out plants by their shape and by their usage. You know, it's kind of that intersection between medieval superstition and modern science. And by the time my characters come along, he had been much discredited. But Ambrose Pike still believes in it and is still sort of looking for the signature of all things in the plant world. And in fact, I feel like every single character in my novel in some way or another, because they're all involved in botany, that they're all trying to break the code of the signature of all things. And in fact, that's what all of science is, and indeed what all of religion is, and hopefully what all of art is that we're all just trying to kind of crack the code on the meaning of life.
Well, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you, you know, reviewers have been talking a lot about how remarkable it seems that you would go back to fiction after you had written these hugely successful memoirs, Eat, Pray, Love, and then Committed. But I was thinking that, you know, in many ways, you're writing about very similar experiences, because Alma has her own eat, pray, love experience when things break down and her love does not go well, and she takes off much as you did. I mean, was that, I assume that was deliberate.
You know, it wasn't, it's weird. It was more, I love my 19th century literature, but I am troubled by the fact that the female characters in those books really only ever get one of two endings, right? You either have a happy ending, which means that you're married. Well, and that you're married to landed gentry, or you have a terribly tragic ending, usually because you made a sensual error and you are a suicide, a murder, or, you know, under the wheels of the train. So you're either, you know, Lizzie Bennet or you're Anna Karenina. and there's right. not a lot in between. And I feel like, you know, then as now, that's not really what women's lives are. I object to the idea that a woman's life is either, she's either rescued or ruined by a man. And I feel like the great crowning superhero achievement of womanhood is the ability to be resilient. And that's something that is just not celebrated enough in fiction. And I wanted to write about a woman who reminds me of myself and just mm-hmm. about every woman I love and admire, which is to say that somebody who doesn't necessarily get every single thing she wants, but who gets what she does not expect and who finds unknown strengths in that, and ultimately who is defined by the work that she loves. So the romantic story in this book, the real love story in this book, is between Alma and her vocation. And I feel like that's something that is not celebrated enough in women's stories, and something that I know intimately.
Elizabeth Gilbert is the author of the memoir Eat, Pray, Love. Her novel, The Signature of All Things, is just out in paper. And speaking of science and art, this is music by Mylis, an artist who works with sound generated by plants. When we come back, John Brockman, founder of the online science salon Edge.org, remembers the people who first introduced him to science: John Cage, Robert Rauschenberg, and the artists of New York's avant-garde. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I am Karl Ove Knausgård, the author of My Struggle, and I would like to recommend a novel by Ben Marcus called Flame Alphabet, which is an absolutely amazing and thrilling novel, which I unfortunately have a bit difficulty talking about because it's a very weird novel. I have never read anything like it, which is a very, very good thing for me. That almost never happened, but it did happen in this novel. The Flame Alphabet is, in a very strange way, about language. But it's also about family life, in a kind of a apocalyptic landscape. The thing is that in this book, children's language becomes lethal. You get ill when you hear children talk, and you can die of it. So what happens is that the main characters have to abandon their child, have to run away from their child, which all the adults have to do. And it's very, very moving, very, very strange. And I think exactly, precisely, this is it. This is how it is in an unexplainable way for me. So I was really, you know, shocked when I read this book. And it's so strong and so powerful and so fantastic and so innovative, and so it's a great novel. And it has also some other parts that are intriguing and fascinating. There are a kind of religious thing going on which has to do with language. They practice their religion in huts in the wood and listen to sermons giving through cables in the ground. It's really weird, everything. But it leads into a kind of, well, I can't say where it leads to, but you have to read it. It is absolutely, absolutely amazing.
Karl Ove Knausgård recommends The Flame Alphabet by Ben Marcus. You can find more bookmarks plus an interview with Knausgård on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. One of the smartest scientific publications around is the online science salon, edge.org. The founder, John Brockman, throws out big questions like what scientific idea is ready for retirement. Then he curates answers from some of the world's most brilliant scientists. Surprisingly, Brockman's own background is not in science, but in New York's avant-garde art world. Steve Paulson caught up with him recently to talk about how the intellectual landscape has shifted in recent decades.
What had happened in recent years, the playing field of intellectual life shifted. The traditional intellectual has become increasingly marginalized. I would say in the last 10 or 15 years, 50s education in Freud, Marx, modernism is no longer sufficient qualification for a thinking person in today's world.
You need to have more familiarity with the sciences now, it would seem. And to some degree, the scientists have become our modern philosophers.
And that's what they were. I mean, that's who people used to listen to and talk to. But the whole world of intellectual life seemed to have gotten hijacked. That crowd, you would call them the New York intellectuals that coalesced around magazines like Paris Review, Partisan Review, Encounter, etc. They became increasingly reactionary and quite often proudly, even perversely ignorant of the many significant intellectual accomplishments of our time. It's a culture that dismissed science. There was this tradition in England of somebody, literary person, saying this room stinks of mathematics. The literary intellectuals got away with it for a long time. The people in science weren't making an effective case of the implications of their work, and that's changed.
What I find so interesting about what you're saying is, I mean, you're really talking about the importance of the scientist in modern culture and the importance of hearing from scientists and the ability of scientists to communicate with the public. But if you actually look back to your own background, I mean, you got your start in the avant-garde art scene back in the 60s. I mean, you used to hang out with people like Andy Warhol and Robert Rauschenberg, John Cage, you know, extraordinary people.
And at an evening with John Cage that he convened in order to try out his new ideas on a young group of artists, all the discussion was about networks, McLuhan, cybernetics.
So he'd have people over for dinner to spark a conversation.
And they were incredible evenings, and I was very blessed to be involved. But
and you were young. Weren't you in your mid-20s or something like that?
24. I had no science background whatsoever, no interest particularly. And all the conversation was about science. It wasn't about art. Wasn't about music. You know, you have these epiphanies in your life where you see everything new and different. The same thing, you know, becomes miraculous that was dull the day before. And that's how you'd feel when you walked out of one of those evenings after talking to Cage.
What did he do? How did he do that?
He would throw out these bon mots, and they would just lead to really fascinating discussions. One evening, he basically laid out the whole idea of the Internet This is in 1965, before the technology was even invented. The whole idea that it's a network, that there's no A to B, there's a nonlinear relationship, which is called feedback, where the output affects the input and you get these loops. We're always in the loop, and the pattern, the process, is the reality.
But it's fascinating to hear you say that some of these ideas that paved the way for the internet actually came out of the art world. I mean, came out of, you know, John Cage, this avant-garde music composer.
They absolutely came out of the art world. And by the time I got out of the Army and arrived in New York and got heavily into the art world, everybody was talking about cybernetics and everybody was talking about non-linearity. If you looked at a Larry Poon's painting, this was op art, and you moved your head just a fraction of an inch, everything changed. And suddenly you realize that you were the instrument, that you were the art. Same with Lamont Young, who was even more than Cage, I would say the dead center of the avant-garde. Lamont did harmonic tones that he would play in what he called the theater of eternal music. This would take place in a factory building of four or five stories, and you could wander through, you could sit, you could walk. And you soon realized, after just a few minutes, although you could stay there for hours, that every movement, every gesture you made changed the music, and you were the composer, or even better, you were the composition. But the key thing is that the artists were highly intelligent, and they were reading science, they were studying science.
Now, going back to that time in the mid-60s, the late 60s, when you were hanging out with people like John Cage and Andy Warhol, we could mention Marshall McLuhan as well. Mm-hmm. Did you know that these people were extraordinary, that they would help shape the future?
It's interesting you mention that, because I've never been asked that, and it's something I thought about at the time, and I think about a lot. I had the good fortune to realize when I was 25 that my colleagues, that people my own age, were historical figures. I just happened to be in the right spot at the right time. And I decided, wouldn't it be interesting to track what this crowd is doing? Not just this crowd, but the people that I found interesting. And that was based on the idea that the words of the world are the life of the world, and nature isn't something we create as much as something we say. Hmm. A finite number of people have created what you and I would call reality.
There's another idea here that I find extraordinary. I mean, you're really suggesting that a few extraordinary people who are visionaries, who are creative, can actually change the way we see the world. In other words, reality doesn't sort of just march ahead on its own. There are individuals who turn it in a different way.
And it's a finite number, and you can actually go through history and identify a lot of them. I mean, Jesus Christ had an idea. That was a good one. But a lot of the people in the last few hundred years are scientists, and more scientists are alive than have ever lived before, and that's a huge change. But even within this world of science, you can identify the person that coined the word quark, the person that talked about selfish genes, etc. We have new ways of looking at things, and we create tools, and then we mold ourselves through our use of them. We become the tools. So your heart is a pump until it's not a pump. If you said your brain is a computer in 1970, everybody was into the human potential movement, you'd get your head taken off. But by 1975, you were right on the mark. By 1980, it was old-fashioned already. People are talking about neural nets.
Let me talk about what you do with your website, edge.org, which has been called the world's smartest website. I mean, it has this amazing group of scientists and philosophers. And what is it that you're trying to do? Because, I mean, one analogy would be, oh, you've created a magazine to display what these various people are saying. But it's not really that. It's something different, isn't it?
It is. I figured out in the 60s that I could make a living pursuing things that interested me. The point was that if I found somebody whose ideas were interesting, or theater or movies, whatever, if it interested me, there was some kind of market and other people would also be interested. And it wouldn't be everybody. And the Edge website is not for everybody. It's basically having an opportunity to engage with the people that I think are creating the world we're living in on an intellectual level, and then sharing it with a public audience on the site.
Now, a lot of people bemoan the state of public intellectuals today, and they say, well, they're not what they used to be. Is that what you're doing here, is trying to create a forum for public intellectuals, for people who, especially in the sciences, to be able to communicate complex ideas to a broader audience, for those who are interested?
No, I'm not interested at all in that. I see it as a conversation. It's allowing the brightest people in different disciplines to present their new ideas. We're not trying to present somebody's golden oldies repackaged for a wide audience. We're trying to replicate what I started in 1980 with the Reality Club. It was before the web, before people were online, where someone would come and present their latest work or try out their latest ideas in front of an interdisciplinary group of peers, people on their own level in different disciplines, with the idea and the foreknowledge that it was New York City, they were going to be challenged. So on any given evening, we'd have 30, 40 people show up either in the living room or most often in the boardroom of the New York Academy of Sciences. And someone like Freeman Dyson would give a talk. And in the room would be Betty Friedan, Ellen Burstyn, Dennis Hopper, Huey P. Newton, Abby Hoffman, poets, artists, writers. It certainly wasn't focused on science at that time. And it became a conversation, and it was often brutal and often exciting. That's what I'm aiming at with Edge. I'm not aiming for the public, quote unquote, because I don't think there is a public out there.
What do you mean you don't think there's a public out there?
In terms of definition of creating audiences, I look at it like a graduate school, and I'm the only student. But you can join in, and you can audit everything, and it's free. It's a gift. I hope you enjoy it.
John Brockman is the founder and curator of the website edge.org. He's just come out with a new anthology called The Universe. Leading scientists explore the origin, mysteries, and future of the cosmos. And to wrap up this hour, we've got some music from the cosmos. A new piece from Italian scientist Domenico Vicinanza. He took 37 years of data sent back from deep space by NASA's Voyager 1 and 2, and he turned it into music. 300,000 individual measurements of cosmic particle data created this. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our producers are Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and we also had help today from Will Henkes. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thank you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.